Okay, so this is Bio241, and it's Monday, September 8th. And what's happening next time?
Test.
You got a test, yeah, your first test. And I sent out an email to everybody. If you didn't get that email, you got to make sure you put your correct address in Blackboard so that you can get it. Who didn't get the email? Make sure you have your correct email address in there. And check your emails, too. Maybe you didn't get it because you didn't check. So let's see. What do you need for the test? Cypress College picture ID and a Scantron like this. This is an 882E. This is the best one, 882E. And you need, yes. Okay, this is a pencil, number 2 lead. And what's the most important thing? Okay, yeah, the eraser. Make sure you get a good eraser. Double check before you come to class. Get your pencil out, make a line, and erase it. And if it smudges, don't use that because you're going to lose points on the test. Because you might see the tests in lab to check them, but sometimes you don't get the test back to check. Right? And if you smudge them up, the Scantron reader won't be able to read them and you'll get gypped out of points. So although the eraser on top of my pencil looks like this one right here, they're not the same. This one's a smudger. Okay? This is the good one. So make sure you double check. Yeah, make sure you get a good eraser. You might not ever use it, but in case you do have to use it sometime, that's what you want to do. All right, so does anybody have any questions about the test? Ah, there it is. All right. It's going to be multiple choice, maybe true-false, matching. Could be short answer. I suppose there could be an essay. I don't think I have an essay on this test. And it could even be a drawing sometime, like draw a certain kind of mechanism out or something like that. Okay, so multiple choice, matching, that kind of thing. Oh, I still don't have the... Oh, I think it was in this class. Last time when I recorded the lecture, there was a problem with the recording, and I had to do some funny things to recover that recording, and it turned out to be a huge file. It's almost like 100 megabytes, something like that. So I'll leave it on the server until you take the test, but I got to take it off the server because it's so big. Because it will break things if I leave it up there. So if you want that last lecture, make sure you go to the web and download it and save it someplace. All right, because I'll probably delete it over the weekend. You won't need it after the test anyway, but I thought I would just let you know. All right, so are you all familiar with your chemical structures? You're studying your chemical structures? I hope so. You know, like what a phospholipid is, what glycerol is, all that kind of stuff. Okay. On the internet, all right, so this is the homepage for, that's on your syllabus. And did I show you that? I don't think I showed you this before. The flash quiz, this is just a movie file. It didn't work last time. Let's see if it works this time. It worked for me after I went home. Okay. There's something on there. Well, we have video. What about audio? Ah. Okay. So you can practice this at home. What's that? Amino acid. Phospholipid. See, it even tells you what the correct answer is. Okay. I know it's awfully slow, but this is just the first time through it.
lipid, carbonyl group.
Carbonyl. Yes, a slide previous to when I say it, not afterwards.
Ribonucleotide. Sulfhydryl group.
Okay, so you guys seem pretty good at this.
Amino group.
So we could go faster, right? So you could just go.
Glycine. Alpha helix or secondary structure. Deoxyribonucleotide. Hydroxyl group. Glycerol. Phospholipid. Carbonyl group. Ribonucleotide. Sulfhydryl group. Amino group. Carboxyl group. Phosphate group. Monosaccharide. Saturated fatty acid. Triglyceride formation. Monosaccharide.
All right, so that was fast, so you kind of just have to work. Yeah, you just have to work your way up to doing it. If you do it a couple times slowly, then this fast is okay. But the nice thing is that what can you do? You can take a break if you want to. Like if you get a phone call, like right now, you can just pause it and go back to it later. And I think you can of course, right-click and save that on your hard drive and practice that if you wish to do that. You want to go over it some more? Okay. Slower. Well, if you want to do it slower, we got to come over here someplace. All right, we got to start more at the beginning. Okay, well, not quite, because I talked too much at the beginning. All right, so that one we missed. What about this one? Phospholipid.
Phospholipid.
There's an echo in here.
Prostaglandin. Alpha helix, or secondary structure.
What's the building block of secondary structure? Right. And what is secondary structure used to build?
Tertiary.
The tertiary structure. Yeah, tertiary structure. Okay. One of these days I should just give a test completely like this. You got to say it before I do. Excellent, excellent.
Carbonyl.
Okay, let's go back. Let me show you the difference. Good question. How do I go back? Ooh, I don't know how to step backwards. Maybe, how about arrow? Can I go back by an arrow? No. I just got to click. Sulfhydryl, carboxyl. All right, I'm sorry, I got to go here, and then I'll pause it when we get to it.
Glycerol, phospholipid, carbonyl group.
Okay, this one. Well, I'm not expecting you to recognize the bases. Sometimes by the bases you can tell if it's a ribonucleotide or deoxyribonucleotide, but there's another dead giveaway, and that is this oxygen in this position right here. If it's a ribonucleotide, there's an hydroxyl group right here, but if it's a deoxyribonucleotide, what can you tell me about this oxygen right here? It's gone. You just have a hydrogen atom. So this is a ribonucleotide. Deoxyribonucleotide is going to be missing this oxygen right here. So I understand that when it's just flashing before your eyes and you're looking at everything, all right, this is what you want to key your eye to right here. So this is the ribonucleotide. It's not deoxy. If it's deoxy, it means what? Minus that one oxygen right there. Let's see if that's what I say. Yeah, ribonucleotide. Sulfhydryl.
Hydro group. Amino group. Carboxyl group.
Don't slow down.
Phosphate group. Monosaccharide. Saturated fatty acid. Glycerol plus 3 fatty acids go to form a triglyceride via dehydration synthesis reaction.
That you got to know. I think I've mentioned that before.
Monosaccharide. Micelle.
What's the building block of a micelle? Phospholipid.
Cholesterol and 3 steroid hormones. Unsaturated fatty acid. Amino acid. Now we're going to go a little faster.
Not really fast.
Phospholipid. Prostaglandin. Alpha helix. Or secondary structure.
Okay. So it's missing an oxygen, so this is the deoxyribonucleotide. And what is this the building block of? DNA, right? Nucleotides are building blocks of nucleic acids. And you know two kinds of nucleic acids. There's DNA and RNA, and this one goes into making DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. This is a deoxyribonucleotide.
Deoxyribonucleotide.
Yeah, that's what I just said.
Hydroxyl group. Glycerol. Phospholipid. Carbonyl group. Ribonucleotide. Salt hydro group. Amino group. Carboxyl group. Phosphate group. Monosaccharide. Saturated fatty acid. Triglyceride formation via dehydration synthesis reaction. Monosaccharide. Micelle. Cholesterol and 3 steroid hormones. Unsaturated fatty acid. Amino acid. Okay, now we're going to go through.
All right, so I'm going to stop it right there. But the cool thing about this is that you could probably study this at 2 o'clock in the morning and turn the sound off because you don't really need to hear what's going on because you can just read what the right answers are. Right, so that's why it's captioned, so that you can study this even without hearing what's going on. All right, so you know where to download this thing at if you want to look at it again? Okay. Where? Here. It's not www, it's just sem.cypresscollege.edu/, and then that's a tilde J. Gober. And that's just a website that I have on the first page of the syllabus, so you can always find that. But I think I sent... There might be one on Blackboard. Yeah? You got yours on Blackboard? Yeah, it's a virus. Watch out. There might be one on your computer soon, too. It's the same thing? Good. Okay. Okay. All right. Any questions? All right. Well, if we have a lot of time left over, I suppose we could do that again. So... let's see what's on the test. 1, 2, and 3. Chapters 1, 2, and 3. Is that correct? Is that what I told everybody? Okay. And are we done with chapter 3 yet? No? All right. No, not even. Okay, so we better stop goofing around. And look at some of this stuff. I don't think I need to go back and talk about anything in particular. Except, you know, I should have put a flash quiz up for... Maybe I do have a flash quiz for organelles as well. You should know organelles. All right, but we're talking about genetic control. And what do genes produce? What do genes produce? Genes are necessary to produce what? Proteins, that's right. So they code for proteins. And don't forget that central dogma, biology, in order for a cell to make a protein, it's got to have RNA. RNA comes from DNA. So DNA is the repository of that information on how to build a protein, which is the structure of your cells, but also proteins can be enzymes. So they control chemical reactions in the cell. So it's the so genes control the structure and function of cells. And if something happens to that DNA, then of course the cell is going to die. So what are the two-step processes? There's transcription and translation. And did you say them in the correct order, the time sequence of how they would happen? Transcription happens first, right? Always in the nucleus, translation. What do you need for translation? You need a ribosome. You need a ribosome, and you have ribosomes in the cytoplasm, and ribosomes are made out of ribosomal RNA, like what I have right here on the screen. Okay. And the nucleolus is the place that's actively making ribosomal RNA. All right, so let me start the show and get my cursor going. All right, so I forgot exactly where we left off last time, but the genome is just the complete set of genes that you have in all of your chromosomes. And don't forget that those genes make proteins. So if we look at all the complete set of proteins that can be made by all the genes in your body, we call that the proteome. And we used to think that there was a one-to-one correspondence between these, so that if your body had 100,000 different proteins that it made, that it required 100,000 different genes. Just a one-to-one correlation. But we now since have learned that that's really not quite true, and we're going to see how we can explain that. All right, so I think we talked about this too last time, about how DNA is packaged to be safe. Right, it's packaged into a chromosome, but on a molecular level, nucleic acid, the DNA nucleic acid, is wrapped around histone proteins, and histone proteins are put together to form a nucleosome, and nucleosomes are put together just to form these massive coils of DNA. And I read one time, I never measured this myself, but I read one time, if we were to take all the DNA that's in your body and all the cells and string it from end to end, you know how far it would reach? It would reach actually 250,000 miles. Now, does anybody have in your mind a good landmark of what 250,000 miles is? Well, if you took an astronomy class, you would see that that's exactly the distance to the moon. That's pretty far. If you were to take all your DNA and string it from end to end. Because don't forget, you have trillions of cells in your body. So I find that fairly interesting. All right, we talked about that. RNA synthesis. The enzyme that makes RNA from DNA is called a polymerase, and in particular an RNA polymerase. And a gene, when it becomes activated, has to be activated by binding of a transcription factor to some region on the chromosome that we call a promoter region. And once a transcription factor binds to that promoter region, transcription for that one gene can take place. So this is a way that transcription is controlled or regulated. Genes are not used all the time. They're turned on and off, just like lights in this room right here with a switch. So these transcription factors, along with a promoter region on a chromosome, acts as a switch to turn that gene on and off. All right. All right, so let me know if we talked about this slide last time. Did we talk about this one? I think we did. All right, so don't forget that first the DNA has to unzip, because what's going to happen is that one of the strands of the DNA molecule is going to act as a template for making RNA, according to the base pairing rules for RNA. Right? Not for DNA, but for RNA. So what's the difference in RNA compared to DNA? Okay, the sugar is different, right? For RNA, it's a ribonucleic acid that's put in there, but there's one different base as well. Okay, this uracil is used instead of thymine in DNA. So you can always tell a sequence of DNA from a sequence of RNA because DNA is going to have thymine and RNA is going to have uracil right here. So for RNA, the base pairing rules are AU and GC instead of ATGC. All right, and can you tell me again the name of the enzyme that is making this RNA molecule right here? It is the RNA polymerase, because this RNA is a polymer, and a polymer just means what? It's just repeated subunits over and over and over and over again put together by what kind of reaction? Y'all know it. Y'all know it. How did we make a triglyceride? A dehydration synthesis reaction, right? So your body uses that for this particular reaction as well, the RNA polymerase. Okay, so here are basically three forms of RNA that are made. Ribosomal RNA forms the workbench for translation. So it goes into making the ribosomes. There are at least two subunits that come together to form a ribosome. The transfer RNA is wandering around the cell, and it will bind an amino acid and bring it over to a ribosome so that it can be incorporated into a protein at the proper time. So sometimes I think of the tRNA or transfer RNA as like a taxi RNA. It's another name for a taxi. Is there another name for a taxi that starts with a T?
No.
No? Okay, I think they're called taxi pretty much everywhere in the world. It's funny how that is. And messenger RNA contains the code for synthesizing a protein. So what's the building block of a protein? Amino acid. And what do we call the primary structure of the protein? What is that? That's just a sequence of amino acids in a protein. Don't forget there's 20 different kinds of amino acids. The primary sequence just says which one is in the first position, which amino acid is in the second, and in the third, and in the fourth. And the messenger RNA contains a primary sequence of nucleotides, which will determine the primary sequence of amino acids in a protein. So if you change this primary sequence of nucleotides in messenger RNA, guess what you're going to change? You're going to change the primary sequence of amino acids in the protein, which then do what? Change the secondary structure and the tertiary structure, and more than likely the function and structure of that particular protein as well. All right, so messenger RNA is most directly related to the primary structure of a protein because it's just a nice linear sequence of nucleotides. All right, so what happens in the nucleus during transcription is that messenger RNA is not directly made from a gene. There is messenger RNA that comes before that, which we call pre-messenger RNA. And pre-messenger RNA has to be activated before it can make a protein. And that's what we see in this slide right here. Basically, activation of the pre-messenger RNA. So here we see a double-stranded nucleic acid. So what can you tell me about a double-stranded nucleic acid? Is it DNA or RNA? It's DNA, right? And before it can be transcribed, right, it has to unzip. And then one strand is going to act like a template and allow base pairing to take place. So going from DNA to RNA is called what kind of process? That's transcription. Where does it take place? In the nucleus, right? So here is a big, huge, long molecule. But notice that there's some heterogeneity in this molecule right here. You see some dark regions and some light regions. And that is this whole strand of RNA is not used to make a protein. Some of this material, namely these darker regions right here, are never used to make a protein. And we call these regions introns. The regions that can be used to make a protein are what we call exons. And it just so happens that these introns like to form this hairpin loop, and we see some base pairing in this region right here that stabilizes the root of this loop right here. And furthermore, there are enzymes that come along and cut the messenger RNA, splice these two ends together, And your cell, as far as we know, this might not be true, I suspect it's not true, but as far as we know, these introns are just discarded in the cell. Right? Your body doesn't use these segments of RNA, they're discarded, but these segments of exons can be spliced together, and now this is a nice competent messenger RNA that can be used to make a protein. All right, so that's kind of interesting about these introns right here. Someday we'll probably find an important reason why they're in the cell and maybe be able to relate it to some kind of disease process and then maybe figure out how to prevent that disease process or treat the disease process by knowing what to do with these introns. So you'll just have to stay tuned. Maybe for the rest of your life you'll have to be learning this stuff, okay? But that's the way it goes. All right, so the human genome has only about 25,000 genes. Yet, those 25,000 genes will produce 100,000 different kinds of proteins. So, do you see a one-to-one correspondence here, or is there a difference? There's a difference. Which is bigger, the genome or the proteome? The proteome is four times bigger than the genome. So on average, one gene codes for an average of three different kinds of proteins, at least at our level of understanding. And how can we explain this? And the way that we explain it, you should know. All right, so here we have a pre-messenger RNA, and how many different exons are in this pre-messenger RNA? You see? Three different exons. That's the usable part of the DNA. So for instance, the exon number 2, the one right in the middle, maybe your cell could use this segment right here for making a protein. Or maybe your cell could use segment number 1 spliced together with segment number 2. That could make a different kind of protein in your body. Or maybe your cell could use another kind of protein where the first, second, and third exon are spliced together to form a third kind of protein. All right, so can you see how different proteins can be made from the same gene by splicing together different exons that are all transcribed by in that one gene? Or what? Maybe the second and third exon would be spliced together to give you another kind of protein. So here you have one gene giving you the possibility of many different kinds of proteins. And so that phenomenon of putting different exons together to give you different proteins inside the cell is what we call alternative splicing. So alternative splicing explains why the genome is smaller than the proteome. All right, so that's actually pretty important information. So on the slide it just says this allows a given gene to produce several different kinds of messenger RNAs. Okay, this slide right here, I'm not going to talk about or test you on silencing RNA. That might be important sometime, but I won't test you on it. Here we have a nice electron micrograph of a part of protein synthesis. These little dots represent ribosomes. And this thread that we see going from right to left across the slide right here, and I see it right here, that's a messenger RNA. And surrounding the messenger RNA at all these different little locations, these little dots I said were ribosomes, so they actually attach to the messenger RNA, and the messenger RNA actually moves right through the ribosome. So this is the beginning of the messenger RNA. A ribosome will attach over here, and then it will read the whole message. And when it reads the message, it's just going to move down the messenger RNA. And when it's in this location here, the messenger RNA is going to say, add a particular amino acid to the protein that you're making. So, can you tell which proteins are longer that are attached to a ribosome? Is this protein longer, or are these proteins over here longer? The one on the left-hand side or the right-hand side are longer? The right-hand side are longer. So these ribosomes over here started out over here, and they have read the whole message and added amino acids together in just the right sequence, and they're producing these big, long proteins as a result of that. But the ribosome has to move down the messenger RNA. All right, so what's the building block of this protein right here? See this protein right here? What's the building block of that? Amino acid. And it's just not a random sequence of amino acids, right? It's a specific sequence that has been determined by the sequence of nucleotides in this messenger RNA. So in order for this ribosome to add an amino acid, it's got to get an instruction from the messenger RNA right here. Okay, so what's the RNA molecule that's bringing in amino acids from someplace in the cytoplasm to this ribosome that's making a protein? What are those little molecules wandering around and bringing amino acids to a ribosome called? That's the transfer RNA. All right, so that really kind of describes all the different kinds of RNAs. The transfer RNA is bringing amino acids to the ribosome. What's the ribosome made out of? Ribosomal RNA. And this long string of nucleotides right here is the messenger RNA, and that's going to tell the ribosome how to make this nice long string of amino acids. Right? So the primary sequence in messenger RNA determines the primary sequence of amino acids inside a protein. Now, you haven't seen how that happens yet, so let me describe how that happens a little bit. How many different kinds of nucleotides do we have in RNA? How many different kinds of nucleotides? So you only got four, right? And you know the base pairing rules are GC and AU. You got four nucleotides. But how many different kinds of amino acids are there? There's 20. So you can't just use one nucleotide to determine which amino acid goes into the protein, because you only have four nucleotides. If there are only four amino acids, then you could use one nucleotide to determine what amino acid goes into the protein. All right, so as a result of that, in order to, say, call for the insertion of a phenylalanine, for example, into the third location of this growing polypeptide chain, you need three nucleotides in sequence. And that's what we call the triplet code. So now, even though you only have four bases, you have enough different combinations of these triplets right here to code for all 20 amino acids, all 20 different amino acids. So that's why we need a triplet code to do that. And this slide right here is a short form. I don't think I have, it's just a short form. We stop right here at glutamic acid. But don't forget, there's 20 of these amino acids. And each 20 amino acid is going to have a different triplet code. This is what we call the universal genetic code. And actually, this is probably one of the most amazing things that you will find in your textbook, because not only does it show you what triplet is necessary to how to code for an amino acid in a protein, but all life uses this genetic code. So it hardly changes from humans to snakes to insects to bacteria. It's the same genetic code and is used as a line of evidence in supporting a particular theory. Anybody know what particular theory I'm thinking of? Evolution, right? It's how all life is kind of bound together by common rules, and this is a rule that's found in all life. And so we call this the universal genetic code. All right, so on this slide, what we see right here, this triplet of nucleotides, is what we call a codon. And probably what you should do, you should modify this slide right here, because in this column, it's leaving off an important little letter. How many different kinds of RNA do you know about? Yeah, basically three. You got that pre-messenger RNA, but that's basically just a precursor to a messenger RNA. You just splice it together differently. But what are the three main kinds of RNA that you're aware of? Messenger RNA, ribosomal RNA, and transfer RNA. And where these codons exist are not in the transfer RNA, not in the ribosomal RNA, because those go into making ribosomes, right? These codons are located in the message itself on how to make a protein. And what kind of RNA is that? That's the messenger RNA. So modify your notes and actually draw in a little M right here. And then draw an arrow looping over the RNA pointing to this codon, because you should know where the codons are located. The codons are located in which kind of RNA? The messenger RNA, not the transfer RNA, not the ribosomal RNA. but in the message itself. All right, so if this is a nice messenger RNA, can you tell me what the primary sequence of nucleotides is? Could you tell me what the primary sequence of nucleotides in this messenger RNA is? It's what? It's A, bound to a U, bound to a G. What's next? An N? An A, U, or UAG, sorry, UAG. And then what? U. So what do we call this structure right here? Just this linear sequence of nucleotides. These are ribonucleotides. This is what? This is the primary sequence of nucleotides in messenger RNA. And what is this first triplet called? That's a codon. Right. Okay, so that's a codon. Where did this nice primary sequence of nucleotides come from? DNA. Yep, DNA. Bless you. Okay. So let's write the DNA up over here. How would RNA polymerase make this nice, what, messenger RNA? All right, so you know what that process is called? So here's going to be some DNA right here making messenger RNA. What's that process called? You all know, that's transcription. So what are we going to do? We're going to go backwards. We're going to do some reverse transcription. And you'll see how easy that is. All right, so here's DNA. What's going to be the primary sequence of DNA that's going to make the messenger RNA right here? So A is going to, let's see, A, T. That's right. That's going to be a T. A, C, right? And then A, T, C. Oh, what do we got here? A. All right, because these are deoxyribonucleotides. These are ribonucleotides right here. You see the primary sequence of DNA determines the primary sequence of RNA. And then by using the triplet code, we end up with the primary sequence of amino acids on our next line. So if we go down one more step, what do we have? AUG. Okay, it codes for methionine. That's just a name for an amino acid, but it also is an important start signal. Okay, when you read a sentence, what do you see at the beginning of a sentence? A capital letter, so you know it's the beginning of a sentence. Unless it's Spanish, what do you see in the beginning of a sentence sometimes? Yeah. Okay, an upside down question mark. It lets you know something about the sentence before you read it. That's really handy. You know that it's a question instead of just a sentence, right? So start signals are real important. All right, so this is what? Start. Right here, AUG is, stop. Well, that wouldn't happen for real. Okay, so let's just forget that. So then the next one is going to be what? UUU is phenylalanine. And then there's going to be another amino acid over here. What has to be in this location on the messenger RNA to get another amino acid here? Another triplet, and then another triplet, and another triplet. And what are these triplets called again? Codons. These are codons. Okay. All right, so I want you to see primary sequence of DNA determines the primary sequence of RNA through transcription. And this primary sequence of nucleotides can be used to make a primary sequence of amino acids in a protein. This happens in the nucleus. This step happens in the cytoplasm. What's the organelle that's necessary for this arrow to take place? A ribosome. And bringing amino acids to the ribosome is, what's the kind of RNA bringing amino acids to a ribosome? That's a transfer RNA. Okay. So this is the code. All right, a codon. Where do you find codons? In the messenger RNA. Well, this is sort of like what I did on the board. Not as nice a figure, but it's close. All right, here we see a double-stranded nucleic acid, so this has got to be... Yeah, DNA, because DNA is the only one that's double-stranded. How else do you know this is DNA? It's got thymine right here, no uracil, right? It's got no uracil anywhere here. So we just see GCAT, base pairing is double-stranded. So in order to transcribe this nucleotide, what do we have to do? We have to, well, unwind it and then unzip it. All right, we need to separate the strands, and here's the strand that's going to be used. This is the coding strand, which is, I guess this one right here is CGT. I see a CGT. So it's been unzipped, and the RNA polymerase can now allow base pairing to take place with ribonucleotides. And so here's the primary sequence of DNA, TAC. That's going to correspond to a primary sequence in messenger RNA. That's what? AUG. And then the next triplet's going to be, what, GGC, base pairing with CCG in DNA. So here is, so what do we call this structure right here of the messenger RNA molecule? What is the structure of the RNA molecule? This is the primary sequence, right? The primary sequence of this messenger RNA is what? Quite literally, it is AUG, GGC, UCC. That's just the primary sequence of this messenger RNA. Right? So what do we call this process of converting the primary sequence in DNA into a primary sequence in RNA? That's transcription right there. And you know that's got to happen in the nucleus because the DNA can never leave the nucleus. All right, then the messenger RNA dissociates from the DNA. And is that easy to do? Or is that difficult to do? It's easy, but you should probably have a feeling for why that is easy. Why is that easy to unzip this RNA molecule once it's made from the DNA? Because what can you tell me about the bonds between these bases right here? They're put together only with hydrogen bonds, so they're weak bonds. So it's easy to zip and unzip these molecules together. And when it unzips, this messenger RNA leaves the nucleus, goes into the cytoplasm, combines with a ribosome, and then the ribosome will look at three nucleotides at a time to figure out what amino acid goes in each one of these positions. And on this slide, we have seven different positions. So that means how many nucleotides do we need? Probably what? 3 times 7 is 21. And if you count them over, I'm sure there's 21 right there. Because that triplet right there is what we call a codon. So the ribosome is going to put a methionine at the start signal. That's a signal that that's the beginning of the protein. And in the second codon, GGC signifies that glycine will put there. What's bringing this glycine to the ribosome? The transfer RNA. Right? And then another transfer RNA is going to bring a serine. And right, the messenger is UCC. Okay, so this step in the cytoplasm, going from a primary sequence of ribonucleotides into a primary sequence of amino acids is called, what's that called? That you should probably have on the tip of your tongue. That is what we call translation right there. That's translation. And where does translation take place? In the cytoplasm, right? And it's got to be on a ribosome in every particular case. But where can a ribosome be? A ribosome can be in one of two places. It can be free, or it can be on rough ER, or it can be on ER making it rough, right? Rough endoplasmic reticulum. And the fate of this protein, depending on what ribosome it's on, it can have two fates. If it's on rough endoplasmic reticulum, it's going to be incorporated into a vesicle, maybe for secretion, but if it's a free ribosome, this protein is just going to float around and dissolve inside the cytosol inside the cell and stay inside the cell to control activities of the cell. Okay. Well, this is what a transfer RNA looks like. I'm not going to ask you to memorize what the structure is, but it's really small. And this is how the ribosome knows where to put an amino acid. This area up over here is going to attach an amino acid. This area down over here is what we call the anticodon. It will bind to an RNA only to some specific rules. And those are the base pairing rules that you're aware of. So here we see an anticodon of UUA, What is the sequence of the codon that this anticodon can bind to? It's going to be AAU. All right, so there's going to be a segment on a messenger RNA someplace where this transfer RNA can bind, thereby donating this particular amino acid to the protein that's growing. All right, so let's take a look at this. So this is a nice illustration that shows translation. This big red area over here is the ribosome, and you can see actually two subunits of ribosomal RNA that comes together. And it's going to bind the messenger RNA. What do we call this triplet of nucleotides right here on the messenger RNA? That's the codon. And the ribosome is going to move along the messenger RNA, revealing a codon one at a time. All right, and when it's in this active site right here of the ribosome, a transfer RNA can bind to it. Now, how does this transfer RNA know to bind to this location right here? Because of base pairing rules, complementary base pairing rules, and these, well, let's zoom into this region right here. So it's too small to tell you what nucleotides are here. So let's zoom out to this region right here. So here we see a triplet, which is CUA. So what transfer RNA can come in? One that has an anticodon that's complementary to UAC, and that's complementary to AUC. So what's complementary to AUC is UAG. That will fit in there, and then that amino acid can be attached to this growing link of amino acids. What do we call a chain of amino acids? That's a protein or a polypeptide. And then when the ribosome moves down to the next location, it's going to add another amino acid, and it moves down to the next triplet, it's going to add another amino acid. But don't forget that this transfer RNA has to keep bringing amino acids to the ribosome to be incorporated into this growing protein. And not any transfer RNA can bind to a triplet. It has to match up according to those base pairing rules. This slide I'm not going to talk very much about, except that, can anybody tell me what kind of an organelle we're looking at right here? This is a highly zoomed in region. This is a membrane. And we have ribosomes attached to it. So that's got to be the rough endoplasmic reticulum. So these ribosomes are attached to the rough ER. Here's a messenger RNA. So instead of the ribosomes moving down the messenger RNA, in this particular case, the messenger RNA is actually being pulled through these ribosomes, reading one codon at a time. Here's a protein that's being made as the messenger RNA moves by. And the protein ends up inside, right, the sac of that endoplasmic reticulum, which we call the cisterna. So this is the interior part of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. So these proteins in here never end up in the cytoplasm. They're always going to be inside of a vesicle someplace, or they're going to be secreted from the cell by exocytosis, which is a different fate compared to if it was a free ribosome someplace in the cytoplasm. So I think maybe you should be able to visualize that. All right, so secretory proteins, that means proteins that are secreted from the cell, leave endoplasmic reticulum in vesicles and go to the Golgi body. And in the Golgi body, they might be conjugated with other kinds of materials, like maybe carbohydrates, and become a glycoprotein. Glycoproteins can become antigens, or glycoproteins can become, well, mucus is a glycoprotein. It's a protein that has a sugar molecule on it. Mucus is slippery. Or a protein can be modified with a lipid, conjugated with a lipid, and become a lipoprotein. So what's the function again of a Golgi body, if you're just going to think of one thing? Packet modifying and packaging, right? So the Golgi takes proteins from the rough ER and modifies it, maybe puts it in a lysosome. We would call that lysozyme. Or maybe it's a product for exocytosis, like mucus. What's the name of a cell that secretes mucus? That's going to be that goblet cell. Yeah, goblet cell. Okay. Proteins can be degraded. by proteases and lysosomes, and there are also proteases in the cytoplasm that can do that, but most of them are going to be in lysosomes. All right, DNA replication. How many more slides do we have? A lot? 10 slides left? 15? Okay, let's talk about DNA replication a little bit. All right, so here we have a cell undergoing cell division. All right, and that process is called mitosis. And what are these cells called? Daughter cells. So that's a parent cell over there. What's the difference between these daughter cells and the parent cell? Absolutely nothing. All right, so don't forget, how many chromosomes are in this parent cell? There's 46. Two different sets, starting with a number 1, number 2, number 3, all the way from down to 23 from your mom, and 1, 2, all the way down to number 23 from your dad. All right, well, if this cell is going to split into two daughter cells, and these daughter cells are going to have what? The exact same chromosomes, right? And the same down over here. Well, you can't just take these chromosomes and split them in half, because what would you have? You would have half the number of chromosomes here and half over here. And that wouldn't be good, because these cells undergo mitosis all the time, and sooner or later, you'd have cells with no chromosomes in them, right? All right, so what has to happen is that this set of chromosomes and this set of chromosomes over here have to replicate themselves. That's what we call replication. So when DNA is used to make more DNA, that's called replication. So before mitosis can take place, we've got to replicate these chromosomes. All right, so now we have basically four sets, and then they split apart just in the right way so that the daughter cells don't miss any genetic material. And this replication, anybody know in the cell cycle where replication takes place? You know mitosis. What's mitosis? Prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. There's another phase in there. Interphase. So replication happens during interphase. So interphase is the growth phase. That's when organelles are replicated. That's when DNA is replicated. That's the preparatory phase for mitosis. So here is what a regular unreplicated chromosome kind of looks like on a diagram. And when this chromosome is replicated, what does it look like? Like that. We still call it a chromosome, but it's really what? Two chromosomes attached at the centromere right here. And then during mitosis, these two chromosomes, which we call sister chromatids. All right, these sister chromatids attach to the spindle apparatus right there at the centromere, and the sister chromatids separate. And as soon as they separate, what do you got? You got a chromatid here and a chromatid here, and they're separating, being pulled to opposite ends of the cell. Eventually, one going over here, one going over here. These are what we call the daughter chromatids. These are the daughter chromatids. So we call these sisters because they're attached, and then they're daughter chromatids over here. So DNA replication is important for mitosis. So let's take a look and see how DNA replication takes place. All right, so we know DNA is a helix, and just like for transcription, the DNA has to unwind and it has to unzip in order for replication to take place. And again, that's relatively easy to do because there's only hydrogen bonds holding the two strands of DNA together. Now, what was the name of the enzyme that made RNA from DNA? RNA polymerase. Well, DNA is a polymer too, and we're going to make more DNA polymer, so we're going to use a polymerase, but not an RNA polymerase. We're going to use a DNA polymerase. Right, so the DNA polymerase binds to each strand and it makes a new complementary copy of the old strand using the old usual base pairing rules for DNA, which is what? GC and AT. And this kind of replication is what we call semi-conservative. But let me tell you, let me show you why that is. Here we have a DNA strand, and you can see it's a nice double helix. How else can you tell me that this is DNA right here? Because of the thymine right there. All right, so there's a helicase that unwinds it and unzips it, and the DNA polymerase can bind, and it's going to bring in nucleotides according to the base pairing rules. So here is one old strand of DNA that's being replicated, and can you see it all the way down through here? A DNA molecule is never broken along the sugar phosphate handrail right here, because if it is, that chromosome is damaged and it can't be used. The whole chromosome is worthless. All right, so the strand of DNA is never broken. It's only unzipped and then zipped back together. Here is the, what? Second strand of the old DNA molecule. And the darker blue right here signifies the new DNA molecule that's being made. All right, so when the process is finished on a new chromosome, we have one old strand of DNA and one new strand of DNA. And the DNA is never broken, ever, ever, ever. So the old strand of the DNA is used as a template to make the new strand. As long as you never break this backbone right here, you can always use the old DNA as a template for making new, and you don't lose any information. What about this strand over here? Here is the old strand of DNA. It's being used as what to make a new strand? It's being used as a template to make the new strand of DNA. As long as we never cause a nick and break the DNA strand. So because the new DNA has one strand that's old and one strand that's new, we say that that is semi-conservative replication. If it was completely conservative, then you would have a double strand that's completely new and another double strand that's completely old. But that's not what we have. We have two new chromosomes, and in each case, half of it is the old strand and half of it is the new strand. So that is what we call semi-conservative. Oh, we didn't talk about mitosis yet. I thought we had. All right, but you've had it in anatomy. So this is kind of like a review. This shows the whole cell cycle right here, the whole life cycle of a cell. And when the cell divides, like I have on the board, we call that mitosis. That's characterized by what? Prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase, just in that order. So you might remember a little funny kind of acronym, right? IPMAT, I-P-M-A-T. And that just shows you what phase of the cell cycle comes after the next one. Like this is interphase, and after interphase comes prophase, right? Okay, so yeah, so you should know all these different parts of mitosis. And interphase is broken up into, interphase basically is a growth phase, right? Because during interphase, things get split in half. We want to make sure that we have all the organelles in both daughter cells and all the chromosomes in both daughter cells. So G1 is when the centrioles replicate, okay, and other organelles. This S phase of interphase, that's where DNA replication takes place. How would you talk about DNA replication? What kind of replication is it? It's what we call semi-conservative. That means that the new DNA molecule is half the old strand and then a completely new strand. Okay, and then G2, it's the final growth phase before mitosis takes place. This is where proteins are made for, that are specifically necessary for mitosis to take place. And also during, at the end of G2, right at the end of G2, the chromatin, the extended chromatin, condenses, so transcription stops right at the beginning of prophase, and the nuclear envelope disappears. And when chromatin condenses, we see chromosomes inside the cell. Right, so that's a nice indication that mitosis is taking place. And the chromosomes attach to the spindle apparatus. at the central mirror. Where's that central mirror at? That's at the center of the sister, somewhere near the center of the sister chromatids. That's where it attaches to the spindle apparatus. And don't forget, these microtubules act like a little monorail system. They're designed to what? Move things around inside the cell. And they're going to move the chromosomes. How are they going to move all these different chromosomes? So that they do what? So that they line up right at the equator of the cell. And when they're lined up perfectly at the equator, we call that metaphase. And then quickly, the sister chromatids start to be pulled apart. And when they're starting to be pulled apart, we call that anaphase. And after they're moved to opposite poles of the cell, then the nuclear envelope starts to reappear. The chromatin comes off of chromosomes and it can be used for transcription again. And the cell starts to split into two. It starts to dimple and separate. That dimple is what we call a cleavage furrow. And the cells separate. And the cytoplasm, including the organelles, remember, because organelles make up cytoplasm, gets separated into the two daughter cells. That process of separating into two daughter cells is what we call cytokinesis. Okay. Well, I sort of don't like this slide, because it's not a bad slide, depending on how you're teaching the class, but I would like for you to know that cytokinesis really should be within telophase over here. So cytokinesis is just the separation of the cytoplasm into two daughter cells, and it happens during telophase. All right, it's not a phase of mitosis itself, just the name of a process. Okay, so that's the cell cycle. That's sort of a review. Cyclins, I'm not going to talk about. Oncogenes, I'm not going to talk about very much, except some genes, when they become activated, can turn a normal healthy cell that has a normal lifespan into a cancer cell. And cancer cells usually don't die at the right time in a person's body. They can live for a long time, and they can undergo many rounds of mitosis and proliferate and actually take over somebody's body. So most cells in your body are programmed to die at a particular time, and that programmed cell death is what we call apoptosis. That's a normal function for living cells, and that is just to live out their lifespan and then die, and they're replaced by normal healthy cells after that. Okay, so apoptosis occurs as a normal physiologic response. Necrosis, on the other hand, is not a normal physiologic response. This means that a cell is going to die due to pathological changes. What might be a really common way that a cell is going to die unnaturally, an unnatural death? Radiation, that's right, like X-ray, for instance, which we could have in our hospitals, for instance. That's why radiology technicians know how to protect themselves from radiation, because it's damaging to the cell. It destroys chromosomes. But if you cut off blood supply to an organ in your body and it doesn't have oxygen, those mitochondria can't make ATP, and you run out of energy and the cells die. So, for instance, your brain. How long can your brain maintain consciousness without oxygen? 3 seconds. And then after 3 minutes, those cells actually die. And so we say that those cells in the brain after, or the heart, when somebody's getting a heart attack, when they die, they necrose as a result of that. So necrotic tissue is just the remains of the living cells that were there, but those cells are dead. Necrotic tissue is dead tissue, and that's due to some kind of pathological change. All right, so here is a diagram that shows the two sister chromatids of condensed chromatin being attached right here at the central mirror. We talked about these phases already. All right, does anybody have a question about mitosis? But I think you've run into mitosis already, pretty much. Interphase? How would I characterize interphase? A nice cell, I mean a nuclear envelope? right? The nuclear envelope is intact. I don't see any chromosomes inside the nucleus. Chromatin is extended. Maybe you might see a dark spot. What's that dark spot again? The nucleolus. And what can you tell me about the nucleolus? The nucleolus. Why is it there? Why do you see it? That's the active part of the nucleus that is being transcribed. In particular, rRNA is being made predominantly in this region for protein synthesis. So this is in the growth phase of the cell cycle, which is what? Interphase. It's not mitosis. Then, when everything's ready, when the cell's ready, it can undergo mitosis. We see extended chromatin condensing into chromosomes, and these chromosomes have been replicated. I don't know if I see any centrioles in here, but the illustration, we see two pairs of centrioles or centrosomes moving to opposite sides of the cell. I don't see a nuclear envelope anymore, so that's also characteristic of prophase. The nuclear envelope disappears, and the chromosomes have attached to the spindle apparatus, and they move them around to the equator of the cell, so this is now metaphase. So you should be able to identify metaphase. And when the sister chromatids separate into daughter chromatids, this is anaphase. And when they're pulled all the way over to the centrosome complex, and that would be telophase. And then during telophase, another process can happen. The cytoplasm separates. What do we call the separation of cytoplasm into two separate cells? That is cytokinesis. So mitosis could be thought of as the separation of the genetic material into two separate cells, and cytokinesis could be thought of as the separation of cytoplasm into two separate cells, right? So the separation of the cytoplasm is really just a subset of mitosis. And don't forget, that's called cytokinesis. So a centrosome is, well, I'm sure we've gone over this already, but here we see two centrioles making a centrosome complex. Can anybody tell me what the job of a centrosome is? It organizes the microtubules inside the cell, so, and that helps give the cell a particular kind of shape or changing the cell shape, but these microtubules also move organelles around inside the cell, including chromosomes during mitosis. So the centrosome organizes the microtubules and gives the cell shape and moves organelles around inside the cell. Talked about that. Well, we didn't talk about this. This is sort of interesting. Let's go back to a chromosome. Where did we have a chromosome? So here's a replicated chromosome, right? This is two of them ready for mitosis. These ends of a chromosome are what we call telomeres, the tips of a chromosome, or these sister chromatids. And every time a cell divides by mitosis, there is an enzyme called telomerase that chops off a little bit of a telomere right here. All right, and so you can tell when a cell is older because what happens to the length of this chromosome? It gets shorter and shorter and shorter. And then at some point in time, that cell is just going to die because it's run out of these telomeres. So controlling these telomeres with telomerase is a way to control how long a cell is going to live for. Now, what kind of cell pathologically lives for a really long time and just undergoes mitosis time and time and time again, maybe thousands of times, maybe hundreds of thousands of times, just replicating itself over and over and over again in a pathological way? That would be a good example of cancer. And in some cancers, we found that that telomerase is not acting properly. The chromosomes aren't being, the telomeres aren't being chopped off, and therefore these control signals for apoptosis or natural cell death aren't being listened to, and the cell just lives for way too long a period of time causing these cancers. So to understand that mechanism and maybe stop that from happening is important for treating cancer. Right? So you're actually learning some very nice molecular reasons why we want to learn about all this stuff clinically. Okay. So another kind of cell division And I think these are the last slides that we have right here. Yeah, because I'm not going to talk about epigenetic inheritance. And I'm not sure how much meiosis is going to be on the test. But let's see, we started at 2. And we've got like 10 minutes. Okay, I can give you a short overview of meiosis. At least give you a flavor for what's going on. Okay, so here we have these daughter cells, right? These are daughter cells. And what's the difference between these daughter cells? Nothing. Because mitosis takes care of that. So this kind of reproduction, now don't say that, I might ask you, what's the purpose of mitosis? Just don't say reproduction, because mitosis is reproduction. But so you want to know, what's the purpose of mitosis is to? Growth. It's for growth. Oh, maybe didn't I tell you this? And two reasons for mitosis. What are the two reasons for mitosis? Okay. Let's go over that. I probably won't be able to finish meiosis today, but that's okay for the test. Here we have a normal parent cell. And you have two sets of chromosomes, right? A number 1, number 2, down to 23. We call those maternal chromosomes. And then you got another set, another one that's almost like that one. It's a number 1 and number 2, but it's different because it comes from your dad. So we call those paternal chromosomes. All right. So there are two copies of every chromosome in this particular cell right here. And so since it has two copies, we call this cell diploid. That's a diploid cell. It has two copies. Another way of abbreviating that is we say it is 2N, standing for numbers of sets of chromosomes. When it undergoes mitosis, what's the ploidy of these daughter cells? Okay. Now don't forget, this is mitosis right here. And are these cells, these daughter cells are identical, but how do they compare to the parent cell for mitosis? They're the same. Okay. So the parent cell is the same as the daughter cells, and the daughter cells are equal to each other. So this is like a process of making clones. These cells are being cloned in your body. So this cell is diploid. So these cells have to be diploid as well, because there should be no change. There should be no change, because they still have the same numbers of chromosomes. So this is a diploid cell as well, or you could say 2N. This is by mitosis. So don't forget, there's no difference between the daughters. There's no difference between the parent cell and the daughters. They're just being duplicated by mitosis. No change in DNA material or anything. Okay, I forgot the next point I was going to make. Cloning process. Ploidy. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Let me erase this over here. Oh, I know what I was going to say. All right, so this is a process of reproduction, right? We're making more cells, but these cells are identical to the parent cell. So is that a process that you're going to have to start thinking about it in this way? Is this a sexual reproduction or asexual reproduction? Look around the room. This is what we call asexual reproduction because, right, the daughter cells are identical to the parent cell. But if there's a process that is producing something new and unique, we don't call that asexual, we call that sexual reproduction. So if you look around the room, how are you produced? Asexual reproduction or sexual reproduction? Sexual reproduction. Because why? Well, you could look around a big room and never find anybody that looks like you at all, right? So that's sexual reproduction. It produces diversity in a population. All right, but mitosis is what we call asexual. Produces the same thing over and over again. So that takes us to meiosis. What about meiosis? Meiosis is the process of producing one of two kinds of things. And one of these you'll recognize right away, which is a Sperm. Okay, what's this organelle?
Flagellum.
All right, so this is a sperm. And so that's going to come from a male. This is going to come from a female. That's an oocyte, or I'll just say egg, right? And generally, you should know the term for these two different kinds of cells. And these are what we call gametes. So there are two different kinds of gametes. Males are sperm, females are egg. But now, let's look at the chromosomes that we have inside these. It's going to be different than what we have over here. Guess what you have? You only have one set. You only got a one number one, one number two, one number three, all the way down to 23. And then this egg cell, same thing. A one number one, one number two, all the way down to 23. So these have half the number as most normal cells in your body. So now, what is the ploidy of these cells? These are the ones that are haploid, because they have just one set, not two sets. So gametes are what we call haploid, or we could say one end, one set, right over here. And you're going to see how it's going to make sense in just a little bit, maybe in a week from today, because you got to take a test next time. So we can't finish this probably. All right, but let's take this egg and this sperm, put them together. They're going to form a single cell. And this cell now is what? Has these, what, paternal chromosomes and these maternal, right? So now you got two sets. What's the ploidy of this cell? This is going now back to diploid. This is what all the cells of your body are like. And what's that process called? Okay, I'll give 10 points extra credit for the first person that says in the next 2 seconds. Okay, fertilization. Yeah, you knew that before you took this class a long time ago. Right, this is fertilization. Right? That's fertilization. So fertilization will take two haploid cells and make a diploid out of it. So this is kind of a, and do you know what the name of this guy is down here? Or gal? This is what we call a zygote. So a zygote is a single cell product of fertilization, and the zygote can become any cell in your body. And we were all zygotes at one time, but that's not much fun. Why is it not much fun being a zygote? Well, you can't come to a physiology class and take notes and stuff like that, because that zygote has to undergo mitosis. All right, two reasons for mitosis. I forgot to mention this. One is growth to get big, like if you're a zygote, no fun. And number two, replace old and damaged cells. So there are some cells in our body that only live for about 120 days. Does anybody know what cells in our body only live 120 days? Red blood cells. Right? And then they have to be replaced by new cells, and that process of replacing those old and damaged red blood cells is what we call mitosis. All right, so somebody next time is going to have to remind me, just to give you a little brief description of meiosis next time, after the test. Don't forget to download that lecture. Last time, for the test, what's the Scantron you need for the test? 882. What's this? What's this? Good eraser.